I'm Bob Diem, an alcoholic. And only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, that I've accessed and maintained in my life through a process outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to remain sponsorable and a persistent and consistent effort in trying to push myself aside and serve a purpose greater than myself, which is helping other drunks. Consequently, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering medication since October 31st, 1978. It's my personal best, actually. I want to thank the committee for having us here, and Margot. Somebody should have I hope somebody videoed that. It'd be on YouTube. Margot and the Bat. You know, it was like. I'm so glad you did that, because I just was sitting there thinking, I've never told my story where I have to duck every once in a while, you know? So I don't have to worry about that anymore. And I'd like to welcome the newcomers. I'm real glad you're here. I hope you realize what you have, that this is the only fatal disease that uses your own mind against you. And that's why so many of us die, sometimes by suicide, sometimes by drug overdoses, sometimes by just car crashes, and we don't even know what's killing us because of the way this sickness talks to me in my own voice, in my own head. And I think it's me. It's crazy. When I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 20 years old, and I was in a treatment center for drug addiction because, you know, when it says in chapter 3, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. Oh my God, that was so true. I'm so defended against this truth about me. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I had uncles that were alcoholics. I don't want to be an alcoholic because they're obnoxious and pathetic. I'll be just about anything other than an alcoholic. I'll be a drug addict because that's kind of sexy and cool. There were rock stars that were professed drug addicts. I'll sign up for that. I'll be a mental health case, because if you're a mental health case, you get pills and sympathy. I like both of those. But my God, I don't want to be an alcoholic. And it doesn't matter. If you have alcoholism, you can die from something you don't even want to believe you have, as many of us do. And when I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm talking about some universal experiences if you're an alcoholic. Now, if you're not really an alcoholic and you're just here because you're tired of the Elks or something, I don't know. I don't know why you'd be here if you weren't an alcoholic, but there are people end up in AA that just had a little problem with something and they came to AA because they were bored. I'm not that guy. It's life and death to me. And that's why I tried not to take myself seriously at all. I have a tattoo on my arm that says Rule 62. But I try to take AA seriously, because my sponsor used to say that it's pretty hard to have something change your life that you're not willing to respect. And I think that's true. When I say I'm an alcoholic today, you know something about me. You know that there was a time in my early drinking where I became obsessed deeply with an effect produced by alcohol. That used to confuse me, because I'd be in treatment centers through the early and mid 70s, and people in treatment centers would say, well, you have an obsession with alcohol. I thought, nah, not really. I have an obsession with the effect produced by it. And why would that be? Because it was the only thing, truly, truly, the only thing that I ever found that set me free. The only thing that allowed me to come out and play. The only thing that was a shield against all my feelings of not enoughness and my shame and my guilt. I could get drunk and just shed all that stuff. I could get drunk and shed and transcend the loneliness that was inside of me. And I used to have this thing all the time. If I was sober and I was at a party or anywhere and I'm sober, I have that feeling like it's all of you. And then there's me, separate and apart from. And I don't know what it is, but it's almost as if when I'm sober, some invisible yet impenetrable barrier rises up between me and life. And life's over there, and I'm over here. And there's a line in our book, it says, the alcoholic will know a loneliness such as few do. I've drank in halfway houses, got on passes, and went and got drunk because of that. I also, when I drink alcohol, it's like makes me, there's a guy I always wanted to be, and I become that guy when I'm drunk. My parents, I had a high IQ, so they were always badgering me with my potential, and it's whatever that is, Jesus. I just remember thinking, yeah, one of these days I'm gonna unleash my potential. You better all look out, you know. I can never find it. When I started drinking, I found my potential. Oh my God, who knew that in a pint of whiskey was 34 Arthur Murray dance lessons? Who knew that? Who knew in a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose there was enough finesse that I could talk to girls? Who knew that there was freedom there? I didn't, and only alcoholics find that out. Because alcohol does something for me that it doesn't do for non-alcoholics. And if you ever been around non-alcoholics and watched them drink, they're weird. They are very weird. In 1978, I'd had some credentials as a therapist, and I, against my sponsor's wishes, I took a job as a counselor. I was the director of inpatient treatment for a thing for teenagers with drug and alcohol problems. My sponsor thought that was a bad idea. He said, you don't get paid for this stuff. I just thought he wasn't smart enough to figure out how you can help people and get paid for it, you know, like, and oh my God, he used to rib me. I only had that job for a year, thank God. You say, it's the blind leading the blind. I had a sponsor that had the needle out all the time for me. And I'm not even sober 2 months, and I just started working there. And it's a nonprofit, so they have a fundraiser. Mandatory. All the staff has to be there. And it's a cocktail party. Try to imagine 2 months sober and you got to go to a cocktail party. Oh my God, I couldn't get out of it. And I didn't know what to do. I was scared. Because I'd never been around alcohol without drinking. I just cave. It talks to me. And I didn't know what to do. And I went to an AA meeting and I told some old timer about it. And he said, oh kid, it's easy. He said, the problem is not being around the alcohol. The problem is the feelings you'll get of not fitting as everybody else gets high and then there's you. He said, you got to find something you can do there that's of service to get connected at this cocktail party the same way you got connected in AA. You become useful. You do something of service. He said, I'll tell you what you should do. Why don't you ask your boss if you can be the bartender? You don't drink, that'd be great. Everybody talks to the bartender. Nobody expects the bartender to drink. Nobody tries to force a drink on the bartender. It's a good job for you. And I thought, yeah. And I went to my boss and he said, yeah, that's a good job. You don't drink, that's perfect. You be the bartender. And what that guy in AA said was true. Everybody talks to you. And I'm talking to them. And I'm feeling useful. I'm feeling connected. That lonely feeling of separation isn't there. I mean, I'm being funny, I'm joking with these guys. And something really bizarre started to happen. Because, you know, I want to be a good bartender. And people start bringing their drinks back aggravated because they're too strong. I'm over 46 years sober. I still can't get my mind around that. We'll drink half of it, for God's sakes. You know, I mean, I see anybody other than Al-Anons ever took a drink back because it was too strong. I mean, God. But if those people got the effect from alcohol that I got from it, they'd be so grateful that I made the drink really strong. You know what I'm saying? And alcohol did something for me. And when you think about it objectively, if it didn't do that for you, you're not going to let it do to you later what it's going to do to you after the funds run out of it, except I'm chasing what it used to do for me. And I need it. I need the effect. My wife says it. I want to thank my wife for coming with me. She says it best. She says, alcohol became like oxygen. Every time I'd be sober for 5-6 months in a treatment center, and till I couldn't take it anymore, and I'd go out to get some relief, and I'd take that first double shot of whiskey, which the first drink always tastes like hope. And we all do the same thing. That first, you throw that double shot of whiskey down, we all go, oh, like I can breathe. Like I can breathe. Like somebody turned the air back on. I love the effect produced by alcohol. I think it was spiritual in nature. I know that sounds weird, but I remember going into parties and bars, and I'm sober, and I'm not doing well. I'm depressed. I'm worrying about all kinds of stuff that hasn't happened yet. I'm one of those kind of guys that lives in his head solving problems that haven't occurred yet. I'm that guy. I'm the loneliness, the depression, it's horrible. And I walk into this party or this bar, and I want to run out because it's full of people. I don't do people well when I'm sober. But the alcohol's here. The medicine's here. And a funny thing happens. After about 4 drinks, I'm starting to realize I was so wrong about these people. They're really nice people. About 6 drinks in, we're shooting pool together. About 8 drinks in, we're planning our vacations together. I mean, you know, I'm very capable of getting so drunk and feeling so connected that I'll say things like, I love you, man. I'd die for you, bro, you know? And against the backdrop of how lonely and weird and depressed I feel sober, that is magic. But I got something wrong with me and I don't know it. I start to drink and something happens to me that doesn't happen to non-alcoholics. It's almost as if deep down in the core of my being is some unrealized switch. And alcohol is the only thing that'll throw that switch. And it's the got to have more switch. And I can't turn it off. I don't even know where it is. But I'm telling you, when I drink alcohol, that switch gets thrown. And I was 10 years sober. And I listened to a speaker talk about drinking socially for a period of time and then crossing over a line into alcoholism. And I guess that happens. It wasn't my experience. But I remember thinking, was that ever true for me? And I look back through my life. I'm just trying to find one or two instances, you know, where I'm drinking for an hour with my buddies, and somebody said, hey, Bob, can I buy you another one? I'm looking for the time when I looked at them and thought to myself, no, I'm good here, thanks. I couldn't find one instant. And if you can't find one instant like that, then you probably got a problem. And if you can't get enough, you're condemned to have too much. And I didn't know that I had an allergic, abnormal reaction to alcohol that our book refers to as a phenomenon of craving. And I don't know that because I don't see that. Because of the way it uses my own mind against me. And I remember one time, I'm a blackout drinker. Bad. Any blackout drinkers in here? Listen, it's hard going through life when other people know more about you than you do. And I don't know about you guys, nobody ever came up to me after a blackout and said, oh, Bob, you were so helpful last night. You know? No. You peed in our kitchen. You hit on my grandmother. You stole my stash. You told everybody you beat Bruce Lee in a karate match? And it's never good stuff. Well, I had one of those nights, you know, where I'm in a blackout. I'm staying on a guy's couch. That shows you where my progression had gone, because I don't have a place to live. Once my parents stopped letting me in their house and would having to do with me, I ended up on the street so quick, it made my head spin. I wouldn't believe that could happen so fast. But my life would have been propped up by my family. Without their support, I just spun into the abyss. And I come to on this guy's couch. And my blackouts often are not the whole night. It's like I remember little snapshots, and they're never good snapshots. It's the kind of things you remember, these things you don't want to cringe. Oh. And then my roommate he gets such glee out of filling in the blanks for me. Oh my God. And it's one of those mornings where I'm sick and I'm shaken and I'm depressed and I feel horrible. My God, I'm so ashamed of myself. There's a whole group of people now. I can't even go around them. I don't want even to run into them. I'm so embarrassed. I could have went to jail. It's bad. This is horrible. And I'm sitting, as I've sat dozens of times, having conversations with myself about myself. And the conversation's going something like, you know, you can't do this. This, you cannot do this. But I'm supposed to meet a couple of my buddies down at Dots, which is the corner bar. We shoot a little pool. We play music together. And I'm thinking, man, I could sure use that because I'm like this. But I can't do what I did. I can't do that. And then I came up with this plan. And if you're going to go out again, you need a plan. It's not going to change nothing, but it'll soothe you on the way out. You know, you got a plan. I got a plan. Good, I got a plan. And the plan is, I'm going to go down to Dots, and I'm going to slow sip 8 drinks. I never did anything bizarre on 8 drinks. That's always somewhere the other side of 12. 8 drinks. And I remember thinking, I remember feeling good about that. 8 drinks, yeah. 8 drinks, that's good. Good plan. And it wasn't. I went down there, and I had, after about 3-4 drinks, my nerves start to settle down. I'm starting to be able to enjoy myself a little bit. 8 drinks is a good plan. Until I got to 7. When I got to 7, it was like, oh, 8 was such a stupid number. 12's a better number. And I don't understand that this is a phenomenon of craving, an allergic reaction to alcohol that uses my own mind against me, because it doesn't look like a craving. It looks like I changed my mind. I always changed my mind. And so I'm that guy when I start, and I don't want to be crude, but if for me to pick up a drink, it's like having sex with a gorilla. I ain't done till the gorilla's done. You know what I'm saying? So I got an obsession with the effect produced by alcohol. The spiritual feeling, the feeling of connectedness that takes away the shame and the remorse and the loneliness and the feelings of separation. I'm obsessed with that. And I have this allergy to alcohol that I don't know I have, that when I start, I can't stop. And after, I don't know, maybe 4-5 treatment centers, you know? Because I don't want to believe I'm that guy, but you know, you try and fail and try. I failed my way into step one by trying to control and enjoy my drinking. Matter of fact, all the drugs I ever did was to that end. I found certain drugs I could drink all night. Then you don't have blackouts. But then you remember some of that stuff. That's not good either. And then I had other medications and things I'd get from doctors and on the streets that would soothe my abnormal reaction to abstinence. Because I ain't no good sober either. So I got 2 problems. I got a drinking problem and I got a sober problem. And I don't see any of this. But after 4 or 5 treatment centers, I get it that I must not drink. I must not drink. And I started going through several years of swearing to myself and really meaning it, that I'm not touching that stuff again. And don't lecture me about alcoholism. I'm not stupid. I get it. But something happens to me when I get sober and I don't understand it. I'm physically sober and I got plans. You know, the plans, like I'm going to go to college. I'm going to. I'm like a car engine that won't turn over. I'm going to. You know, I got plans. And what happens to me is after a while, man, I start to, I ain't feeling right. I ain't right. And if you ask, as a counselor one time, a couple days before I went on a run that ended me up in jail, he must have saw that I didn't look like I was happy, joyous, and free, I suppose. And he said to me, he wanted to help me, and he said, "Bob, what's wrong?" I remember looking at him, he's a nice guy. I remember thinking, "Man, I'd like to tell you, but I don't know. It's not that there's anything in particular that's wrong, it's just that nothing's right, you know, and I don't understand that. I get sober," and Silkworth says it best. He says, "Guys like me, when we're not drinking, I develop a restlessness. You know, that feeling like you're late and you have nowhere to go, you know? That feeling like you gotta go. Go where? I don't know, but I don't wanna be here. I'm irritable, but I don't wanna be irritable, because the truth is, irritable people irritate the crap out of me. I don't wanna be irritable. But I get this gift that I can see the stupidity in you quickly. And because I'm restless, I need to tell you." And oh my God, it just gets so angst up and so twisted inside me about the stupidity in the world. I think I fancy myself an efficiency expert or something, I don't know. But I just get uptight about this stuff. And everywhere I go, I see stupid people. That job I got at steel mill, big money job. That was the job I always wanted. I always knew if I had that job, that's own a house, own a boat, and own a Harley kind of money. I knew if I had that job working in that steel mill, I'd be there. Man, I'm not even there a couple weeks, and God, the people are stupid that are working here. Go to traffic, people, there's some stupid people in traffic. And then they make you go to those AA meetings where they have all the stupid people grouped in one room, you know? All the happy, clappy, grateful for everything people, you know? Oh my God, I felt this is torture. I burned my life to the ground. I'm depressed. I feel hopeless. I hate myself. I hate my life. And I have to listen to you people tell me how wonderful you are. Oh my God, there's stupid people in AA, just grateful for everything. You ever been newly sober and you're depressed and you feel like crap and you're trying to keep it a secret because you don't want anybody to know how horrible you feel, and some yahoo in AA comes up to you with a big grin on his face and says, "Has anybody told you they love you today?" Get away from me. I know he's going to try to hug me. Oh my God, don't touch me. Oh. And everything is God, 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 God. And I'm an atheist, sort of. I've known some real atheists. I'm telling you, I think I'm an atheist. I'm a wannabe atheist, but I'm not really an atheist. Because the atheists that are really atheists, you got to be very religious about your atheism to be a good atheist. I'm not that guy. I'm a guy who's afraid of God. I'm a guy who, secret in the core of my being, and I don't care what people in AA say, I don't care what preachers say, I know something. I've gone too far. I'm too stained. If there was a God, and I'm choosing to believe there's not, because if there is, I'm screwed. But if there was a God, I'm not good enough for him. I'm too bad at being good and too good at being bad. I went to Catholic school. Nothing wrong with Catholic school. It's the guy I went there, taken there, it was me. And we had this time of the year where you'd go with your whole class to this thing called confession. And you got to go in there in this box and you clear the slate, because they're going to make you go with your whole class to communion the next day. And if you want to really aggravate God, go with a dirty slate to this communion thing. So I go in, I'm like a little kid. I'm trying to be good. And I go into the box and I'm trying to be honest, and I'm telling the priest I've had some impure thoughts, and I've wished ill wishes for people and resentment. I'm telling him all that stuff. and he gives me some prayers to say and some stuff to do. Now, I got to go from the moment I leave that box until I go to communion the next day without thinking nothing, because the nuns used to say, if you think it, it's just as bad. Well, I'm always thinking stuff I'm not supposed to be thinking. I don't mean to. I get intrusive thoughts that are just crazy. I mean, early sobriety, I'd pray and there was a voice in my head cussing God as I'm trying to pray. I mean, I could drive it. I got two movies in my head. One is sex and one is violence, you know? And they're both sins. And I could drive down the street just going, I'll kill him. I'll do her. I'll kill him. You know, right? And I'm racking up millions of years in purgatory, and I'm just thinking. You know what I'm saying? So it was a safer bet for me to take an atheistic stance. And it was hopeful, you know, because I didn't think if there was a God, he's not going to help me. I could see you were some nice people. He'd help you, sure. You help people, you try to do the right thing. Yeah, he'd help you. But you don't know about me. I did some slimy stuff that I never heard anybody talk about in AA. And I had a wealth of shame and self-loathing. Of course I hated myself. Of course I did. My God, if someone else would have done to my family, my loved ones, and my life what I did to it, I'd want to kill them. So of course I hate myself. It's not a mystery. So I don't, and I've always suspected that if you knew about me what I knew about me, you'd feel about me the way I feel about me. And God supposedly knows everything about me. That is not good. And I'll never measure up. And in 1978, I got a weekend pass out of a treatment center, hopeful. You know, I remember. Do you remember if you've been a relapser, do you remember towards the and you're in late stage alcoholism, the best part of every run is the half hour before it starts. The excitement of getting free, the excitement of recapturing that effect. And I started drinking and the effect is gone. The last couple years I drank in depression. I drank in horrible, horrible feelings of shame and loneliness. And I didn't understand what was wrong. And I go on this run and I ended up in jail, facing 2 years in a state penitentiary for a hit and run DUI in a stolen car, which in my own defense, it was borrowed, but that's, I don't really care what I think. And I went before a judge and he cut me a break. He sentenced me to 2 years and then stayed the commitment. He told me I had to go to this place called the Ark House, which wasn't really, people would say it was a treatment center. It was the bottom of the food chain for treatment. I was in a room with 10 guys in bunk beds. All you could smell was ass and feet. You know what I'm saying? One of those homeless guys off the street, that kind of thing. And I kind of fit there. Isn't that funny? If you feel like horrible about yourself inside and your outsides are horrible, there's kind of a rightness about that. You know what I mean? What's hard for me is when I went to my parents, before my parents cut me loose, I'd go to my parents in suburban Pennsylvania, a nice area, nice people, but man, I don't fit there. And so I'm in this place and I'm trying not to drink because if I can just not drink, I can get out of this. The judge said, just get good UAs, good PO reports, make the restitution. You do that for a year and you're off the hook, kid. So I'm trying. And I get to that place, man. Some of you might understand this, where the discomfort, the restless, irritable discontent, the loneliness and depression of abstinence starts to overwhelm me. And I've never shed the hope of jump-starting that medicine again. Even though it hasn't worked right in a couple years, I'm dying from hope. And I take a run at it and it was miserable. And I, you know, I'm one of those kind of guys, I drink and go and cry in Jags, and I just drink and it's bad. It's bad. The party, I remember yelling out to a bunch of guys, I was drinking, passing around a half gallon of wine, I just yelled out to them, what happened to the party? And I wanted to know, what happened to the party? Because it's gone and I can't seem to get it back. And I came to a couple weeks, maybe, I don't know even how long, but I came to on this park bench and I'm in bad shape. I'm shaking uncontrollably. I got sores that won't heal because I don't eat, you know, and my gums bleed and I just, And I'm not against eating, I'm just not gonna eat up my drinking money. And so I can only panhandle so much money, and that goes to, the Richard's Wild Irish Rose is more important than McDonald's in my world. And I come to on this park bench and I'm grabbing myself like this and I'm rocking back and forth like I wanna jump out of my skin. The anguish is unbelievable and alcohol doesn't even work anymore. I'm as sick and I'm as depressed and I'm as lonely when I'm drinking now as I am when I'm sober. And it's no, the only thing that was in my, that any benefit in my drinking the last couple years was oblivion. And that's what I drank. I drank just to blot me out. And that's all I had. And I come to and drinking doesn't work. And sobriety doesn't work for me. I've been sober many, many times. It feels like I'm doing time. I can only suffer it for a little bit. And a doctor that previous year gave me a complete physical. I thought maybe I had a brain tumor. And he said, no, you don't have a brain tumor. You have alcoholism, kid. And if you keep drinking, it's going to kill you. But you're a young kid in my 20s. It might take 5 more years. And I'm on that park bench thinking about 5 more years. Something inside me just went, no, I can't do 5 more days of this anguish. I'm in a trap I can't spring. Drinking has become horrible, and not drinking is horrible. And I am not a suicidal guy, but you put me in that box. A guy who never thought about suicide can start thinking about it because it looks like it's the one option left. Because what am I, when I made up my mind to kill myself, I felt hopeful, I felt better. Because that's what I'm looking for anyway, is the ultimate blot bob out. Because when I'm conscious, I'm in the presence of the guy I hate the most. And so when I thought about killing myself, I actually felt better. But I went to a bridge to do it and I couldn't do it because I'm a coward. I wasn't afraid of death, that wasn't the deal. I was looking down these railroad tracks below this bridge I was on, and the thought came to me, and it was like a horror thought. Maybe this isn't high enough. Maybe I won't die. Maybe instead I'll be paralyzed from the neck down, and I'll lay in some charity ward where people will come in there and just show their newcomers me and say, this is what happens to you when you don't work our beautiful 12 steps or something. You know, and I'm paralyzed. I can't even give you the one-finger salute. There's a line in our book that took an atheist like me and made me willing to do things that I would never do. It says, before a guy like me could ever believe in God or believe in AA or believe in the steps or believe in a sponsor, before any of that, the book says you'll come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of your life, Bob, as you have been living it. Man, God, I believed that. I'd been suffering from the hopelessness and futility of alcoholism for years, and I didn't understand it. And if you have sworn to yourself and meant it that you're never going to drink again and you go back to it, if you've told yourself the lies about with this medication or with this girl or with this town, new town, it's going to be okay and it isn't, and you fail, and you fail, and you fail, I failed myself right into step one, and I couldn't kill myself. I came off that. I broke down on that bridge, and I was sobbing. I don't think I've ever been lower than that. And I ended up through a bizarre series of circumstances trying to hitchhike to California. I suppose maybe unconsciously I was going to try to go out there and join Jack's Al-Anon group or something. I don't know. I was trying to get there because so I could survive the coming winter, because I almost froze to death on a couple occasions. And maybe if I could get out there, I could get phony ID and the police won't find me and I won't have to do the 2 years. And I never made it. I ended up in Las Vegas, a town I would not have chosen to go to. If in a treatment center in Pennsylvania, if they would have said, Bob, we think you're not ready to get sober right now, but we think maybe someday, make a list of 100 cities you might get sober in. Vegas would not have been on that list. We call it the hitting bottom capital of the world, for God's sakes. But we're brought together by divine appointment. And it was a perfect place for me. And I was in this detox, and the Buddhists say when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And there was a man there who'd been a delegate. He did the first H&I meetings ever in Nevada, and he didn't do them. There wasn't even an H&I committee. He did them because, for the same reason Bill Wilson devoted his life. His first 5 months of sobriety, he worked with 96 people, and none of them stayed sober until he met Dr. Bob, because he knew what my first sponsor knew, that his very life and his recovery depends upon him trying to help guys like me. And he'd go into that detox twice a week. And he went week after week and didn't find anybody that was willing to do what we do. And then he found me. And when the student's ready, the teacher appears, and he was the first guy I ever heard share that were, my resistance and my defensiveness were down. And I remember sitting there, first time, and I've been in AA meetings, I've been in 150, 200 meetings by this time, in various institutions. But it was the first time I ever sat there and listened and started nodding my head. And he talked about his suicide attempt. He talked about his depression. He talked about what happened to him when he didn't drink and how he'd swear to himself he wasn't gonna drink and how he would drink. And I'm sitting there listening to this guy and I'm thinking, my God, I'm like him. And yet, I've been watching him come in there twice a week. Something, I'm like him, but yet evidently something has happened to him. Because he appears to be happier sober than I was when drinking worked. I mean, he laughed a lot. I found out later he lived in a mansion up on a hill with tennis courts overlooking the city of Las Vegas. When he first met him, when he came in there, I just thought he was a guy who didn't have a life. He had a huge life. Very respected businessman in Las Vegas. But at the center of this huge life was a purpose, and it wasn't his life. The purpose was to devote his life to looking for guys like me. Our book calls it our primary number one purpose, above everything. And Bob Dylan, I just saw that movie about him. God, I'm a songwriter, so I love Dylan. And he wrote a song entitled, You Gotta Serve Somebody. And boy, isn't that true. And if you don't serve a purpose greater than yourself, you're gonna serve what you served when you got here, which was yourself. And if your primary purpose is you, the only thing I can say is, well, how's that working for you? If you're like me, it's depressing and it's lonely, and you can't seem to jumpstart anything good in your life, and it's you and then them. But when I started claiming my purpose here, my first sponsor was a fanatic about service and 12-step work. I remember, I'm not even out of detox a week, and he wants me to start doing 12-step calls. He wants me to be one of the guys bringing the meetings into the detox with him and his sponsees. And he wanted me to, go to Reality House and all these things, all these help people. He's just like, he's one-track mind. And I reached into my old psycho babble bag of tricks from when I was worked in the field. I pulled out something I thought would impress him. And I said, well, I understand what you're saying, but don't you think I should work on me for a while? And he looked like he bit into a lemon and he reared back, work on you, you've done quite enough of that, stop it. When he said that, I thought, oh my God, I have. I was in rational emotive therapy with Ellis up in New York. I did gestalt therapy, transactional analysis, I primal screamed, I was hypnotized. I mean, if it came up on the radar and there was any hope of making me happy, because I am my number one piece of business. It's all I care about, it's me. And if it came, I took a run at it. Medications, there are all kinds of stuff. And the end result is I'm worse than I've ever been. There's a great line in our book, it's frightening, but it's true. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. And those of you that have relapsed, and this is not your first rodeo, you kind of know that because you feel a little worse about yourself this time than you did 2 years ago or whenever that last time was. So as extrapolate that into the future, can you understand how you could hate yourself enough in time that you'd want to take your own life? And so I got this sponsor. One of the first directions he gave me, and I didn't want to do it. He said, I want you to get down on your knees and ask for help every morning and thank whatever that was at night. And I had to tell him, I said, you know, I'm not going to do it, but I had to say, well, I don't think I can do that. And he said, why not? I said, well, the truth is I don't believe in God. He said, I didn't ask you to believe in God. I asked you to pray. And I thought, oh my, well, if I pray and I don't believe in God, I'd be a hypocrite. He said, oh, we think you've been a hypocrite all your life. Just do it. And it was one of the first directions in Alcoholics Anonymous I was given that I didn't feel like doing. I didn't want to do it. It wasn't my idea, and I didn't think it would work. And I started to take that direction. And I'll tell you something. There's a line in We Agnostics that says, God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. And from the moment I was willing to act like someone who is open-minded to the possibility that there's something, God started showing up in my life. And he started showing up through AA. How many times in early sobriety when I was having a bad day? And I'm not sober long enough to even be awake to what it is that I'm not awake to the fact that it's self-centered fear or it's an unmade amends that's haunting me or it's something I said to someone I shouldn't have said I need to make. I'm not awake to that. I just know I feel horrible. And I ask for help and I go to a meeting and there's some stranger in the meeting. He's talking about that. I mean, he's talking about it in a way that it was like, it just, the clarity of it, I just thought, oh my God, that's exactly what's going on with me. And God spoke to me. Or as it says in the second tradition, he expresses himself, the ultimate authority expresses himself through this consciousness of a group. And God talked to me in AA. That's why I'm very respectful. I go to a lot of AA meetings, and I'm very respectful in those meetings. I'm not on my phone because if God wants to say something to me, I think I'd like to hear it. And even if I don't want to hear it, the guy next to me might be life or death for him. I don't want to interfere with his ability to hear God talk to him through the people in AA. And I started sponsoring people. I didn't feel ready. My sponsor said, listen, kid, if you feel like you're ready before you do it, you'll have already died of alcoholism. Just say yes, and I'll help you. And he did. And it's a work in progress. And when I started, you know, clearing up the wreckage of my past, and man, I had a lot of amends to make, and I had a lot of transformation of my perception to make, and I had to surrender a lot of ideas. I had to give up the idea that the things I thought I was right about them, and I was willing to be wrong, and my life started to change. When I was about 9 years sober, I'll tell you this story and then I'm gonna shut her down. When I was about 9 years sober, it was the first time I was ever asked to speak at an AA event out of town, and it was up in Northern California near the Oregon border. It was near a place called Eureka. And I'd never been up there. I'd never been anywhere, really. You know, I'm just, I'm a bum. But I'm 9 years sober. And I go up there, and they had this monthly deal, and I gave a talk there the best of my ability. And then I had a whole day just to sightsee. And this guy, he's kind of hosting me, I guess. And he's got me in his pickup truck, and he takes me to a place called the Avenue of the Giants. And there was trees there that were like 200, 250 feet high, 25 feet in diameter. I had never seen anything like that. It was like something out of Jurassic Park. It was amazing. And I'm walking around that place, and I'm overwhelmed. And he says, come on. I want to show you these rock monoliths that come out of the ocean. We got to drive down there for a while. So I get in his truck, and we're driving along, and we're going by these meadows and fields. And he says, do you notice how you don't see a 250-foot tree all by itself in a field? I said, yeah. He said, you know why that is? I said, no, I don't. He said, God has created those trees in such a manner that it is their very nature to aspire to these magnificent heights. If they grow up alone, they will literally outgrow their roots' capacity to hold them up and support them, and they will topple over and die on their own aspired magnificence. What must happen is they must grow up in community, and they will intertwine their roots into a net below the floor of the forest, and they will feed each other and hold each other up, and that allows them to grow into God's vision of that tree. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978 after destroying my life in a hopeless condition. I got a sponsor, and I did what he told me to do, and he wanted me to do service. He wanted me to say yes. But I don't feel like say yes. He wanted me just to abandon myself to Alcoholics Anonymous, to make it the center of my life. And I started to do that. And I got service commitments, and it was 9 years in general service, and I was intergroup, and started sponsoring people. And I started doing what he did. I do two H&I meetings, panels every week. And I've done that for over 46 years. Actually, I only do that so I could tell you. No. I do it because it sets me free. Same reason, if you read Bill's story, that he did it. It's a design for living that works under bad conditions. And I didn't know that I was actually intertwining the very roots of my life with yours. I've always had a sponsor who's known they were my sponsor by my actions. I've always tried, even on my worst egocentric days, to show up like a surrendered guy, even when I don't feel like it. And we all know what surrender looks like. You see it in war movies. You're faced with extinction. And what does a person do? They lay down every means of defending themselves. Their guns, their knives, their hand grenades, whatever they got. And then they sit down and they just wait patiently for someone to tell them what to do. And in 1978, I got this sponsor, and I started following his directions. And it was a pivotal moment in my life, truly. It was the moment I became really willing to get my life out of the hands of the idiot that had been sticking it to me over and over again for years. See, I can justify every bad move in my life. I can blame somebody for every bad move in my life. I can come up with an excuse. As I got sicker and my life was crumbling around me, my ability to rationalize and justify and explain myself got stronger when it should have been going the other way. And that's why I'm so lucky to be sober. Guys like me, we die from this disease, and some of us from our own hands. I've had many, many friends in AA that have committed suicide, with up to one friend of ours with 43 and a half years sober committed suicide, 23 and a half years, 32 years. I could just go on and on, dozens of people. Because what do you do if you're suffering from alcoholism and you know that drinking doesn't even help anymore? Suicide starts looking like a good deal. I'm an everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous because of the membership requirement that Bill Wilson, not Earl Treat in the short form of the traditions, that Bill Wilson put out in the third tradition when he said, membership should include all who suffer from alcoholism. The That's why I do everything I do. Because if I don't, I'll start suffering from alcoholism. And when I suffer from alcoholism, I start noticing what's wrong with you. And I need to tell you. So I'm grateful to be in the middle of AA, and you should be grateful I am too. Thanks for listening.